She has been a practicing psychologist, among that 7 years in Cairo, Egypt. She will tell probably about herself, but she lives a truly international life. As you said to me, your home is where you can explain that. Another sentence is, you don't have a home, it's everywhere. That's demanding, but it is a way of living. Which actually gives a lot, not only to the person herself, she says, but also to us, who have her as a guest. Evelyn Lindberg is the founding president of the Human Dignity and Mediation Studies, where I happen to be a lucky member. It is a global transdisciplinary community of concerned academics and practitioners who wish to promote dignity and to transcend, come beyond humiliation in the world, which unfortunately the world is asking for. Evelyn Lindberg is also, the co-founder of the World Dignity University Initiative, Dignity Press, and the World Dignity University Press, where I hope maybe to publish my thesis one day. And all this is not for profit organization. Dr. Lindner's first book, which is based on her doctoral dissertation on psychology, Making Enemies, Humiliation and International Conflict, treated several very heavy, well-known international conflicts in the light of humiliation and evil. And also, a very interesting and quite new discussion on the question of equality, which had usually been very much or only based on the question of economy. But there are many other aspects of the question of equality and inequality. Desmond Tutu wrote the foreword for her third book, Gender, Humiliation and Global Security, and her fourth book, A Dignity Economy, came out in 2012, and now there is another one in the tube here. Last year came another book on honor, humiliation, and terror. This was just as a brief background on who we actually have as a visitor today, and the rest you will hear from yourself. Very welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, a very warm welcome. Konnichiwa, Ohayo gozaimasu. It's wonderful to have you all, and Vidar, thank you so much for inviting me. It's a big honor and privilege for me to be here. I will now explain to you a little bit more where I come from. Is there anybody who cannot understand me just now? Everybody can follow? Yeah, good. This is my father. I think you are not easy. I'm standing in your way a little bit, huh? Is it okay? This is my father. He's born in 1926 in Central Europe. This is the farm he was to inherit from his parents. Should we make it a little bit darker, Annemarie? Is that better?
Yes.
Then came the Second World War. And you from Japan, you know how it looked like after, in 1945. Tokyo looked like that. Osaka looked like that, then Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and all of the Central Europe, all the big German cities looked like that. huge destruction in 1945. This is me. I was born in 1954, and you see my father there, and you see he has lost one arm in the war. He has lost his two beloved brothers, he has lost his farm, he has lost his homeland, he is a forcibly displaced person. About 10 million people in the center of Europe were displaced by force and put some other place. So here is my father, who has lost everything, including his body, parts of his body, is a thoroughly unwelcome, humiliated person in what is later West Germany. It is the British zone after the Second World War. So this is in Hamelin, the Pied Piper city, where he was transported to and where I was born. And I can tell you more about that if you have time after that, because my parents still live in Hamelin, in the Pied Piper city. Who knows the legend of the Pied Piper? Oh, not everybody. Yeah, quite some not. So I will tell that after the lecture. I have pictures here, and you are invited to take some pictures with you home if you like. So it's you will learn about the history of Europe through my life. This is the farm where I lived for the first 6 years of my life in Germany, and you see it's still a farm with many animals and many people. If you go today, it is industrial agriculture there, and the stable is closed and there are 300 pigs in it. But when I was living there, it was still a community where communal sharing was practiced, which means everybody gives what they can and they get what they need. It was a fellowship, a community, where money was not needed much. Only salt and coffee perhaps needed to be bought. Everything else was there in the village. Very different from today in Western societies. So I have learned a lot to appreciate this kind of fellowship without money. I have lived it and have enjoyed it. So after the Second World War, because it was so terrible, the human family felt we have to do something. So this is Eleanor Roosevelt, who was very important with the Declaration, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. She was a very, very important person. It was a window of opportunity after this terrible war to bring this Declaration of Human Rights into the world in 1948. I doubt if we could do it today. So this was in 1948, and what is the core sentence of the Human Rights Declaration? I gave a talk at the United Nations on the 30th of November now, 30th of November, and one of the members in the audience made this brochure for us. And there you see this very, very core sentence. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. This is a huge, huge game changer. This sentence. And I will explain more later. So, you saw me when I was there just a little girl. I stayed in that place until I had finished school. And then, from the age of 20, my life became a project. Not a normal life in a way, but a project to try to work for never again war and never again genocide, and working to end ecocide. Not everybody understands what ecocide is, I think, or do you? Who No. doesn't understand it?
No.
Ecocide, it's the destruction of the ecology.
Okay.
Like genocide is the destruction of a certain group of people, ecocide is the destruction of the environment. And then sociocide, it's the destruction of society. When you remember the farm I grew up in, there was a very, very dense web of relationships on this farm. Today, we have lost this dense web of relationships. We relate to each other through money and through contracts. So this, you can call it sociocide. So my life is a project to answer the following question. What must we do? Now, if we want to have a world in the future without war, genocide, ecocide, sociocide, if we want to have a dignified future for the next generation, what should we do now as a human family on this planet? And what are the biggest obstacles? What we should do is to cooperate, to face all these obstacles. But why do we not cooperate? What is in the way? What stands in the way for global cooperation? Have you ever thought about that? This is my father now. He is over 90. And I think my global life has healed his trauma a little bit. Many of these displaced people, they suffer terribly. Now, today, when they get old, more and more when they get older. So I think I have saved his sanity a little bit through my life. So, as I said, at the age of 20, I began my life as a project. It became a global life. At the age of 20, I started to live globally, on all continents. Now, I'm 63 years old. I have lived globally for more than 40 years, and I am at home on all continents. Until the age of 45, I had the identity of a displaced person, namely, I have no place on this planet, I have no home. Around the age of 45, it changed, and now I'm at home everywhere. I don't have a house in one place, I have many homes all around the world. And I'm at home on planet Earth, in the global village. And this global life has given me a very big distance, like a bird's eye perspective on our human history. The modern humans that we are, the body we have now, the mind, the psyche, when did it start? It started very recently in historic times. Only 200,000 years ago, perhaps 330,000 years ago, the people that were on planet Earth were like us. Somewhat around that. This is a website which I recommend, the Bradshaw Foundation. There you can see how we, as the human family, started to populate the planet. We started in Africa, and then we tried to go to a little bit to Europe, tried sometimes, and it didn't work, but about 70,000 years ago we managed to really make it, and from then, quite quickly, we populated the planet. At the end came South America. We populated that at the very end. So you see, we had a party for the first 95% of our history. We had a party because we could always go to the next valley and find abundant food together and to hunt. It was a win-win situation. And you see, it stops there about 12,000, 10,000 years ago. There is a stop there. You see that? So the last 5%, the last 10,000, 12,000 years of our history are profoundly different to the first 95%. From then on, it became a win-lose situation. somehow we had, the party was over. We had populated this planet, at least the easily accessible parts of it, and we didn't know that the surface of the planet is limited. If the planet were bigger, we would still be migrating, we would still be populating it. But the planet is finite. So at some point, it was bound to happen that we meet other people in the next valley, and we cannot go further. We are stuck here. About 12,000 years ago, there were other changes. There were big climatic changes also. So at that time, we as a humankind, human species, we adapted. We adapted to a new situation, a situation of circumscription. Circumscription is the anthropological word for that something that everybody thought was infinite is finite. We adapted with developing complex agriculture. When you cannot follow the food anymore, if you are stuck in one place, then you have the option to no longer follow the food, but to control the food by agriculture. So this is what we did. It's the Neolithic Revolution about 12,000, 10,000 years ago. Everywhere in different places in the world, it started. So this is important for you to think, you to know that 95% of our history is different than the past 5%. I think it's extremely important to remember. And I have a way to show that. And Tomoka, I need you now. Uh-huh. Could you come? No, not yet. If you just could come. So in the first 95% of our history, we lived in small groups, quite egalitarian groups. This is what the archaeologists tell us. And there was not the big hierarchy in these groups. They were quite egalitarian. So if I respect myself so much, and I respect Tomoka the same, then we are on one line. Is that right?
Yeah.
So this is this one line. If you could sit here, it would be lovely. Thank you so much. And I need you more later. So you see, this is one line. And about 10,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, what did we do? We adapted. We learned to control, to dominate. We dominated nature, we dominated animals, we domesticated animals, and some humans dominated other humans, made them into slaves, into workers. So we erected a gradient, a hierarchy. You see that? And you see what happens here? And now, Tomoka, I need you again.
And now you are
anytime.
So you see a master, a lord do with the people, with the slaves?
Like
that. You see that? And what he, the master, in this, the last 5% of our history, the master felt, or the master had the duty to do that. Like the man in the family had the duty to beat the disobedient wife and children. Mm-hmm. He had the duty. And the king had the duty to keep the underlings down. Underling. And what did many underlings do? This is humiliation. Say the Japanese word for humiliation.
Japanese word for humiliation? Yeah. Is hige.
Hige.
Or haji wo kakaseru.
Okay, good. And now when you are down and you start to believe, okay, this is my place, I should be down, then you have this meek humility, subservient humility. You learn to believe that it's okay to be down. Humility. But a meek humility. What is humility in Japanese?
Cancel.
Okay. So you see how this system worked in the past 5%. The master was like that. The master was arrogant. Do you have a word in Japanese for arrogant?
Goman.
Goman, nose up. Okay? So the master has nose up, and he looks down, and then the people down, they start to believe that it's okay like that.
And this is humility, right?
This is humility, but the meek version, the humiliated humility.
Ah, okay.
Okay? So if you...
Was.
Yeah, and I need you still more a moment later. Yeah. So you see that in that system, humiliation is pro-social. It's a duty of the master to humiliate people underneath. And still today, please, Christine, come try to go around, and here are seats, here are chairs. You just have to be careful with the cable here that you don't fall about over it. Welcome. So, you see, in the past 5% of human history, humiliation was regarded as pro-social. And still today, just recently, I met an economy professor in New York who was from India. He said, Evelyn, don't take the tool of humiliation from me. If we do not humiliate our workers, they will not work. So, humiliation as pro-social tool. And this is what was the norm during the past 5% of our history, everywhere, almost everywhere on the planet. And there is one scholar, her name is Rianne Eisler. She calls this the dominator's model of society. Usually a strong man at the top who sends the young men to defend the in-group at the border, to die early or kill or die, and the women are in the middle to get the next generation out. So this is the past 5%. And now comes the human rights message. What is, I said, you know, every human being is born equal. You see here, what, you remember this sentence, every human being is born equal in dignity and rights. You remember that sentence? Does this sentence fit here? No. How would that sentence be here? It would be, all human beings are born unequal in worthiness and rights, and some are more free than others. And this is nature's order, it's God's will. This is the past 5% of our history, almost everywhere on the planet. So, what is this message, this human rights message? It builds down this hierarchy towards back to the one line that we had before. It is as if humankind makes a U-turn, a normative, ethical, moral U-turn, and says, looks back on the past 10,000 years and says, no, to make some human beings into slaves, to humiliate them down, this is not legitimate. No, no longer is that legitimate. So, like imagine now you are Nelson Mandela. Imagine you are Nelson Mandela and you are born. Where are you born? You are born down among the black people in South Africa. What did Nelson Mandela do? He went up to the white master and he said, now times have changed. There is this new norm of equality and dignity. No longer are you justified in arrogating superiority. No longer. It's finished. Please come down, humble yourself, come down to this line of equal dignity and meet us there. Meet everybody there and let us together build a new future. This is what Mandela said. And he said also, to the white privileged elite, don't cry, oh, humiliation. No, it's humbling. It's a proud humbling. It's a dignified humbling, not a meek humbling. And then Mandela went to the black brothers and sisters and he told them, look, it's not God's will that you are down. No, you have a right to get angry because it's a violation of your human rights. You can rise up, be empowered. Come join us all on the line of equality and dignity. So what did Mandela do by doing that? He brought anger to the people down, and anger that they did not feel before. And this is what human rights defenders have to remember, that they bring anger that was not there before. Who had a right to be angry at humiliation before? Tomoka, if you could stand up again. Okay, now I'm a lord and you are a lord, okay? We are equal.
Yeah.
Like 500 years ago. You are a samurai and I'm a samurai. Okay? Good? Okay, so we are equal. Nobody should be down. I should not put you down and you should not put me down. Okay, now you put me down, okay? You try. Yes, try. And what do? No! I get angry. You know, among samurai, we can get angry.
Okay.
Okay? Only among samurai. But the farmer cannot get angry at us.
Mm, sure.
No, but we can get angry. You see that? So only the aristocracy can get angry among themselves in the old time. Mm-hmm. They can go to duel. You know what a duel is?
Duel. Fighting?
Yeah? Yes. So in the old time, only the elite can get angry at humiliation. What did Mandela do when he went to his black brothers and sisters and said, you can get angry too? He democratized the right to get angry. Just a moment. Only a moment. And so, imagine another case, another example. Have you, you know what a social worker is? And imagine you are a social worker and there is in the neighbor apartment a man who beats his wife. And you go there and you say to the woman, don't tolerate that. You are being humiliated. You have to do something. And the wife says, no. He has the right to beat me because I'm disobedient. He loves me. Beating me is his love. And you say, no, you are being humiliated. So you make her angry. And now comes the big thing that we as human rights defenders have to understand. We should not tell her to kill her husband.
Hopefully.
Do you know what happened in Rwanda? I wrote my doctoral thesis on humiliation, war and genocide in Rwanda, Somalia, on the background of Nazi Germany. What happened in Rwanda? The Hutu, Hutu means servant, were down for many centuries and they thought it was okay. Then they became angry, they got the right to become angry, and what did they do? They did not stop in the middle. In 1994, they rose up further and they tried to kill their former masters, the Tutsis. So to make the people who were never angry before, make them very angry, can go very wrong. So we have to know that we bring, by the human rights message, brings anger into the world that was not there before. And we have to guide that very wisely. And you see there's something, the 1757 is a very interesting date. Because you ask yourself, how come in 1948 is this turning point? Was this very suddenly, from one day to the other, after the Second World War? Or was there something before? And there was something before. And it's very interesting that it is the word to humiliate that offers us a linguistic historical marker of this turning point, already earlier than 1948. In 1757, in the English language, in the encyclopedia, for the first time, the verb to humiliate meant to violate the dignity of a person. It was for the first time that to humiliate was antisocial. before to humble and to humiliate, we're both pro-social. To humiliate your underlings was pro-social, to teach them their lowly due place, to teach them to respect the hierarchy, to teach them meek humility. So 1757 is a very important historical linguistic marker for this turning point where to humiliate becomes antisocial. But humility stays pro-social, but it changes. No longer the meek humility, but proud humility. No, not arrogant, not down, equal, but humility. Proud humility, dignified humility. This is the change. And you might ask, you know, okay, this does not concern us. It's political scientists, or it's for lawyers, this human rights revolution is not affecting us. It is affecting every single little detail of our lives at the micro level as much as the macro level. Humiliation was once pro-social. You see on the left side, humiliation is pro-social, and 1757, humiliation became antisocial, okay? So, now, I bring you many examples. Like 100 years ago in Europe, parents learned that good pedagogy would be to break the will of the child. Like to give the child a pet and then kill it in front of the child. To break the will of the child was good pedagogy. How do we call that now? Child abuse, bullying, mobbing, and so on. Before, you know, the pater familias in the past, the father of the family, the lord of the family had the right to beat his disobedient wife and children. Today we call it domestic violence. Female genital cutting, you know that, is practiced, and killing girls for honor. It has been called a custom. A custom. What do we say now? It's a cultural violence, it's harmful traditional practices, it's a crime. So you see how a custom becomes a crime. This is in the line of this transition there. Then, apartheid. When we hear the word apartheid, we know it's bad. But it was not bad when it was installed, it was a solution, it was called segregation. And protection of our identity. Glorious empire building. All these were positive words. War, genocide, torture are bad to our ears now, but they were once the solution. And satyagraha, waging good conflict. Gandhi's motto, peace is the path. This is what we know now, but in the past and still today, if you ask the Taliban or right-wing conservative people, they would say, no, this is weakness, this is cowardice, this is lack of honor, this is appeasement. This is, people who say that live in the old paradigm, you see that? And then, if you look at North Korea, they would say, we have a happy, very peaceful country. And you and me, you might say, no, it's structural violence. And we have you remember the Iraq war, shock and awe, teaching lessons. This is the old thinking. And today, you and me would perhaps say, no, these are bloodbaths. This is not a path to security, it's a path to insecurity. So you see the transition everywhere. Now I come to what is today very salient. This is the economy. Everybody speaks about the growth, that the economy has to grow. I think in 100 years, people will say, these stupid people in the 21st century, you know, they live in a utopian delusion, because forever growth is absurd in a finite context. So you see the transition that affects every detail in society, in our personal lives. The Me Too campaign. The Me Too campaign, you see? The Me Too campaign is part of this. So, why is this old paradigm there? I said it's called the dominator model of society, and I made this triangle there at the bottom. The past 10,000 years, past 5% of our history, the world was fragmented, compartmentalized, divided. You remember, about 12,000 years ago, the party was over and you were stuck in your valley. You could not go to the neighboring valley because other people were there. What did you do? You became, you know, when you started, especially with agriculture, you became afraid that if you plant something in spring, your neighbors will steal it in autumn. So you get some weapons, some defense, and your neighbor sees it and gets afraid. They get also weapons. You get afraid of them more, you get weapons. So you have an arms race, and everybody gets more and more afraid of each other, and at the end there will be almost automatically war. And what is the motto of this time? The motto is war for peace. If you want peace, prepare for war. This is the motto of what political scientists call the security dilemma. And in this dilemma, everybody was caught, all society was caught. No lord, no king could say, sorry, I'm not part of it, I will be a peaceful king. A peaceful king who did not get weapons and prepare for defense, he would be toppled by his own people and by the enemies. So there was no escape. In the past 5% of our history, there was no escape, and everybody learned it. That this is the only reality we have. And it was the only reality there was. So my question to you, what can we do to change that? What must be done to change that? To get out of this trap of being afraid of each other, preparing for war, which will, you know, bring war. How do we get out of this dilemma? I think this is one of the most important questions we all have to think about in our lives. If the next generation, shall have a life on this planet, then we all have to think about it. No generation before on this planet has carried as much responsibility as you today. No other generation ever before has carried the responsibility you carry. So what do we have to do? Okay, we have to overcome the division. We have to overcome the fragmentation. We have this wonderful picture, which helps us, of our planet from outside. This picture is revolutionary, because for the first time, we understand we are one family on one tiny vulnerable planet. None of our founders of religions, of philosophies, our grandparents, great-grandparents could see that. This is absolutely new. Here, history does not go in circles. History does not repeat itself. This is not a repetition. This is completely new. So you are born into a situation that is completely new. No history lesson can really help you, help us. So we have to manifest in practice the fact that we are one family on one tiny planet. And when we do that, we weaken the security dilemma. We get it out of the way. Because when we are one in-group on one planet, there's no other out-group that can attack us, except aliens. So, then we can realize and manifest the sentence that Gandhi gave us, the motto, there is no peace, path to peace, peace is the path. Then we can realize it. At the moment, we live in times where many people still live in the old paradigm and they want to re-instigate the security dilemma by creating fear of enemies and creating enemy images, because you can, you know, stay in power by doing that in your in-group. So, you saw this lying eight there. You see that at the bottom on the right side. You see the lying eight? This is, I think, the core motto that will help us in the future. Yeah, there are many ways to call it, but I call it unity in diversity. And now I need Tomoka again. Okay? Okay.
I'm getting bigger.
Very good. So, you Oh, you see, now we have the line 8. You see that? You see that? Yeah. We have the line 8, which means Tomoka is Tomoka, I'm Evelyn, but we are one. We are together. Okay? And what I don't do is like that. I don't do like that. I don't do like that. I don't make us one. And I don't say, and I don't say, terrible Tomoka, you are my enemy. I hate you. I hate you. No, I don't. We stay two. It's to be two and one at the same time. This is unity in diversity. Okay? And it's dialogue. It's also a symbol for dialogue. It's a symbol for non-dualism in Zen Buddhism. In Japanese, Zen Buddhism. Now you can see how it is. So in Norwegian, it is Enhet I mangfold, Enighet I mangfold, Samhold I mangfold, Samhørighet I mangfold. One can have many, many ways of saying it. And you remember Vidar's talk? Vidar, you remember how you explained this overcoming intergroup prejudice? You had this nice picture there at the bottom. This is unity in diversity. You see that? And then I told you that I was living in Japan from 2004 to 2007, was teaching at Rikkyo University, among others. And I came in touch, got in touch with a very interesting communication scholar, Muneo Yoshikawa, and he drew on Martin Buber's idea of dialogical unity, the act of two different beings meeting without eliminating the otherness or uniqueness of each. Martin Buber is a very known philosopher in the West. And then what he did was to connect that with the Buddhist non-dualistic logic of not one, not two, the twofold, and it's the notion of soku. Soku in Buddhism, it's a twofold movement between the self and the other that allows for both unity and uniqueness. The dialogical unity does not eliminate the tension between basic potential unity and apparent duality. So this is non-dualism. And I, if you ask me where I stand in philosophy, or I am a non-dualist. I think this is unity in diversity, the double swing model, the line 8, all that is a good guidance for the future, for us. So unity in diversity, as I said, Tomoka, you remember, I said, it's not uniformity without diversity, where I swallow you up, it's not that. It's not division without unity, it's unity in diversity. This is a picture from the Stavanger Museum. These are proud Vikings. And you could also say proud samurai. You could have the same picture. And you see that in the past 5%, we have many men, especially men, have associated their own psychological well-being with glory. The glory of fighting. And this is, I think, the big problem we have today. That many males, men, they, you know, if there is no war, if there is no enemy, where is their identity then? How can they be male? So I see also perhaps Donald Trump here. He is similar. So we have people now who are missing the glory of malehood, of being male. They miss the glory. And there was glory. Now it's not needed. It's dangerous. It's today dangerous. Right. You see, it can lead to that. And for the world, it is suicidal if it continues like that. So this need for glory is suicidal for all of us. So now I come a little bit more, because my talk is about humiliation, so that you understand humiliation a little bit more. Tomoka, I need you again. in the old time. You imagine he is, I'm a king, and Tomoka is also a king of a neighboring country or neighboring tribe. Okay, so I conquer you, I humiliate you. This is conquest humiliation. And then I keep you down, okay? This is reinforcement humiliation. And then I keep you a little bit more down. This is relegation humiliation. And then when I don't like you at all, I kill you or I exile you. Okay? This is the old system. And you see that there are different degrees. You still are alive. You still are alive. Only at the end you are out. But here you are still in, a little bit further down. What is the big new thing with dignity, with human rights ideal of equality and dignity? Now you are out immediately if I treat you less than equal. You know, if I see you as equal and I put you down, you are out immediately. You should be equal. So you see, here are many, many variations of humiliation where you are still in. Only the last is very bad. When, as soon as people have internalized human rights ideals of equal in dignity, they will be hurt immediately. You know, no violation of this equality in dignity can be tolerated. It is immediately the worst version of being put out of the human family. So therefore, the introduction of human rights ideals introduces the very intense form of humiliation, more intense than before. So this is one. Thank you so much. Thank you. So this is one reason for why it is more important to study humiliation today than it was before. Because humiliation becomes more important, more salient than before. And it is through the introduction of human rights ideals. So here, I know that, Branwyn, you don't speak Norwegian. I put a Norwegian slide in because I want to be nice to the Norwegian people, but there are not so many Norwegian people here, so therefore I will jump over this, okay? So, what is the difference between these two paradigms? Traditional paradigm, honor humiliation, is embedded into a culture that mutilates the human psyche to be complicit in perpetrating inequality in dignity. This meek humility, to learn this. It thus flows from an inhumane manipulation of who I should be, namely swan or arrogant, and can lead to brutal reactions. Yet, it can also be solved through negotiations, contracts, and alliances. This is the advantage of this old system. Then it leads to peace that is defined as keeping my enemies out and my own people down. This is the definition of peace in North Korea. Keeping enemy out, my own people down. This is the definition of peace in the old time. The emerging paradigm, dignity humiliation, is embedded in a culture that nurtures respect for equality and dignity. It thus flows from the integrity of the core of who I am. And it can help to lead to deep, genuine suffering that can be healed. You know, when I humiliate Tomoka, then it is genuine suffering that can be healed only through genuine truth dialogue, apology, forgiveness, not through negotiation or money or so. And it leads to peace that is defined very differently to the past. It's defined as genuine unity in diversity dialogue between equals. So these two universes are irreconcilable. I have worked many years in Egypt and in the Arab world, and not only in Egypt, you have honor killing. Imagine you are a therapist, a psychologist, imagine. And there is a woman sitting there and says, my daughter has been raped. This is, the family honor is being humiliated. We have tried to cover it up, we have tried to marry her to the rapist, nothing helps. And now we have to kill her, because the body of the family is now in danger of being infected by this dishonor. And we have to cut this diseased limb, which is the daughter, to save the body of the family. I love the daughter and the family, but I have to sacrifice the daughter for the family. And then imagine you sit there as a therapist. What do you think? You think, how come that killing somebody can heal humiliation? This girl has been raped. She deserves therapy, trauma therapy. She deserves to be to live, not to die. So here we have two universes that do not go together. In one, the girl has to die. In the other, the girl has to live. And you cannot say yes to both. As you cannot be neutral in that situation, a bystander, and say, do what you want. No. You cannot condone that the girl should die and live at the same time. And then there is, when I, as a clinical psychologist, say then to the mother, but look, what a bad mother are you? How come that you think of killing your daughter only because she was raped, you know? How come you want to kill her? You are a bad mother. Then what would... And I would say, I feel humiliated simply by listening to you. My humanity is being humiliated. What would this mother say then? She would say to me, you are an arrogant Western person who humiliates my culture. Okay, so we have two irreconcilable universes where the girl dies, the girl lives. And on top of that, we have a dynamic of humiliation. So this is the situation we have today in the world. And then we have, so a sense of humiliation. I see that time is running, so I'm going a little bit quicker. So if somebody feels humiliated, in the past, one option would be to go down for the underling to say, okay, it's God's will, I'm down. Another is the Hitler path, to say, no, we have to fight. This is the Hitler path. And then there is a very new path. This is the Mandela path. It's changing the social system. And now, why is humiliation so much more important as a topic now? I call it crossover. This is perhaps the biggest danger now. You see there on the left side, this is the old paradigm, the traditional paradigm. The subordinates, the people who are down, they are expected to accept subjugation. The aristocrat, the samurai, he will be going for an eye for an eye, for victory or defeat, duel or combat. The elite will fight. Okay, now we have the new paradigm, okay? The human rights ideals paradigm. The sense of humiliation, as I said before, the sense of humiliation is more intense, more existential now. It legitimizes anger and resistance in bigger groups of people who were not angry before. And imagine now a young person with an immigrant background here in Norway, a young person from Pakistan who feels humiliated in Norway, and he has learned the ideal of equality and dignity, and he feels humiliated, very humiliated, because of this ideal, more than he would 100 years ago. And what would we expect from this Pakistani man? We would expect from him to go the path of Abid Raja, to become member of a party and to take part in Norwegian politics to make the suffering of Pakistani humiliated men easier or change the situation. But there is a much easier way for a young man, much easier than to become member of a party, get an education. It's much easier to say, go back to the old paradigm and say, now I'm a hero, I will fight. Much easier, quicker. So this I call crossover. It starts with dignity humiliation, which is more intense than honor humiliation. It starts with that, but then it jumps back into the old paradigm. This is the crossover that is, I think, extremely important and dangerous, because now a young man who knows a little bit about hacking, if he gets angry and wants to fight, he can just, hack into the energy system in Norway or in Japan or the electricity system, and the whole country can be destroyed by one hacker today. So this is a very, very dangerous trap there, and we have to be very aware of that, all of us. And now I think we have another security dilemma. You remember the old security dilemma is one state one valley is afraid of the other, and they get weapons. And they get more and more afraid of each other. Now we have another border, another fault line in the world between the famous 1% and the famous 99%. You remember the motto of the security dilemma is, if you want peace, prepare for war. I think many people now believe that if you want wealth, invest in exploitation. This is the belief today, and 1% makes it, and the 99% lose out. Here you see me at Zuccotti Park in New York, where the Occupy movement met in 2011. Again, how can we overcome that? By understanding that we are one family and one tiny planet, and if we all engage in exploitation, we will not survive on this planet. We need to work for globalization of care and trust rather than globalization of exploitation. You remember this? Advertisement? Perhaps the younger ones not, but this was an advertisement once. You were a good man, proud man, smoking is good for you. And what do we have now? Smoking kills. And this will be the same with our economic beliefs. Exploitation is good for you. You will be wealthy. No, it kills. So, what do I think we are? Where are we as human family today? We live there on this Titanic. This is the Titanic, okay? The rich people, they live on the first floor. And they paint their cabins pink, and they play games. And the poor people are down. The rich people have one very big interest to block the poor people from coming up. So they build barriers so that the poor people cannot come up. And the rich people forget that the wisdom, the knowledge for surviving on this ship is down and not up. So the poor people down, they have one aim, to come up. And what do both overlook? What do both overlook when they are trying to come up or hinder coming up? What do they overlook? We live in a historically unparalleled new situation. We live in a completely new situation that we didn't have before, the iceberg. This is new. This is new. And you live in this new, very new situation. And if we hit this iceberg as humankind, what will we do? We will drown our planet and burn it. This is what we are doing now. And I know that from global living. We burn it and we drown it. So, just to summarize now, we have some important dates in human history. We started about 200,000 years ago or 300,000 years ago. The dates vary now. And it was, in the beginning, it was a win-win situation. We were always could go to the next valley and find wild food. It was a party. About 12,000 years ago, the party was over. Because one reason is that the surface of planet Earth is limited, and we reached the limit. And what we started to do was a win-lose competition for domination. This is what we learned. In 1757, as I said before, this is a very interesting linguistic marker. Egalization, I call it the turn towards egalization. Egalization is short for equal dignity. I call for the humanization of globalization through egalization. I call for egalization. So this is why I coined egalization. Then in 1967-72, for the first time, we see the blue planet from outside. And this is another revolutionary image. Because to see something from outside is a game changer. You from Japan, you look at Japan differently when you are in Norway. When you come back to Japan, you will have a different image of Japan. So you understand yourself better when you look from outside. So this is extremely important. In 1980, we started to overuse the resources of one planet. Now, we use 1.5 planet, And soon we will, you will need 2, 3, 4, 6 planets if we want to continue like today. But we do not have 6 planets. In 1991, the Cold War ended, and we had the chance to manifest that we are one family on one tiny planet. We had this chance, and we did not use it. So, in 2008, the collapse of the blind belief in the market. Still, most people believe in it, but not anymore blindly. Now, what is our task now? It's overcoming the terror of systemic humiliation that we have now. So, if we look again on our history as a human family on this planet, the first 95% we populated the planet, we spread out. We could manifest unity in diversity in our group. It was horizontal expansion. In about 12,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, we hit the fact that the surface of the planet is limited. Circumscription means something that we thought is unlimited, suddenly we understand it's limited. We, as human family, we adapted by vertical expansion, by domination, learning to dominate, uniformity in division. This is the past 5% of our history. Today, we again hit the fact of circumscription. We thought that clean water is infinite. We thought that clean air is infinite. Oil, minerals, everything. Now we understand everything is finite. So what should we do? What should you do? You carry the responsibility now for this planet. You are actors now. So what should we do in this situation? What do we do? What we do is look back on the past 5%. We learned how to dominate, how to compete for domination. That is what we learned. And what do we do now? We maximize this. You cannot see it. It's a exponential curve there. Oh, it's too dark there. Exponential curve. When you hear in the news that we need economic growth, then it is an exponential curve, which in a finite context is not possible. We need, and you see it's a circle there, you cannot see it. What we need to learn is to go in circles rather than unlimited growth. And we have the chance, as I said, we have the absolute amazing chance, the window of opportunity, we have all the knowledge to now learn how to go in circles, to look back 10,000 years and say, okay, we learned competition for domination 10,000 years ago. Okay, we learned it then. And the 5% of our history now, we did that. Now we have to learn something new, namely to go in circles. And Rihanna Eisler, she says there is the dominator society of a model of society, and then there is the partnership model of society. And we can now, we have all the knowledge, and you have all the knowledge, and you have the responsibility to build one family who lives together in partnership and unity in diversity. I gave this talk on the 30th of November at the UN in New York, and I went, I saw this, they're in the corridor, and you see that they are very good aims, very good. Life should be better. The aim is to make a better future. It's called Sustainable Development Goals. The UN has defined these goals. And what do you see there as number 8? It's an exponential curve. It's a growth curve. Going up. You see number 8 is going up in a finite context. This is impossible. And it will undermine all the other good intentions. Do you know this? Anybody who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. Do you know this talk or this saying? Kenneth Golding. So we have to be careful. We have to think. You are actors. You are not passive slaves in a system. You can change. You can think. And we have one philosopher in our network who has thought about it very, very much. Is it greedy bankers? Politicians? No, it's a structural problem that goes back 2,000 years. Today, our economic systems and structures are organized according to the old Roman law, which is very interesting. So, but I will go over that, time is running. This is North Korea. Up and down you see Morumba in Sao Paulo, where I was in 2012, and you see the rich overlooking the slum. In both cases you have huge inequality. You see that? Huge inequality. There are some at the top, some elites, some few people who have everything, and then the rest has almost nothing. In both systems, so-called socialism, communism, capitalism, all systems so far have led, have created sociocide, the destruction of society. And they have created ecocide, the destruction of the environment. This is what we have done so far, because everybody engaged in competition for domination. So if we, my idea now, comes my idea, okay? Do we need ism, like communism, capitalism, socialism? Do we need isms? Perhaps not. But in case we need it, then why not take dignity? Why not say dignism? This is my idea. I don't take it so seriously because I don't like ism, but let's say, what would dignism be? What would it be? It would be a world where every newborn finds space and is nurtured to unfold their highest and best, embedded in a social context of loving, appreciation, and connection. A world where the caring capacity of the planet guides the ways in which everybody's basic needs are met. A world where we are united in building trust and respecting human dignity and celebrating diversity, where we prevent unity from being perverted into oppressive uniformity and keep diversity from sliding into hostile division. So this would be my definition of a good future. So I call for a globalization of care rather than a globalization of exploitation through competition for domination. So here we have this blue planet, and now we are drowning it and flooding it and burning it. Okay, so how can we go and save it, save the blue planet? How? What do I do? I tell you now what I do, okay? And in order to tell you what I do, I have to switch hats. I carry two hats. I am the, as Vidar said, I'm the founding president of a global dignity movement. In that capacity, I'm a unifier. You see that? I have the hat of unity. But I'm also a researcher on my own right. And in that capacity, I have a different hat, namely that of diversity, that I am just one member in a big network of diverse scholars and thinkers and practitioners. So until now, I had the hat of researcher. So you do not have to believe anything I said until now, okay? Don't believe me. You have to think yourself. What I said so far is meant to inspire you. You should not believe me, okay? Until now. Now I switch hat. I put the head of unity on my head now, okay? And now I tell you what we do in this global network of dignity. It's called Human Dignity and Humiliation Studies. It's a global fellowship, as Vidar said, of like-minded academics and practitioners. It's not-for-profit labor of love for a new future, for a better future for humankind. It is for something new rather than against something else, old. We have about 1,000 members in the core invited globally. It's upon invitation. And about 7,000 on our address list. We were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 2015, 16, 17, or perhaps this year again, which has helped many members in our network, in, especially in areas in the world where to speak up for dignity is really dangerous. This nomination has helped us a lot already. We have two conferences per year, one in New York. You are warmly invited in December, to come to New York. It's called the Workshop on Transforming Humiliation and Violent Conflict at Columbia University. And then we have each year a different conference in a different part of the world. So here we had the first one. You might not see who this is. This is Arne Naess. He was present in our first conference in Paris in 2003. And here is our conference in Stellenbosch in Africa, South Africa, 2013. And here we met a very interesting member in our network, Catherine Odora Hoppers. She made a picture of what I have been saying to you. She said, look, the small conflicts in this world, like the blacks fighting the white people, all these small conflicts and solving them is futile because there is this crocodile. We are all in the mouth of this crocodile. And what is this crocodile? This crocodile is what I call security dilemma 2, namely the economic structures we have at the moment, which somehow eat into every single detail in the mouth of the crocodile. So this is her image. Then we had our conference in northern Thailand in 2014, where we learned something that I hope the Sami, I would so much love to the Sami to go there, to the Karen people in the north of Thailand, who taught us how a village should be organized, and who explained to us how the obligatory schooling, the obligatory education in the school destroys the village life, how children are learning to sit still on chairs and march to military songs, and when they are 12 years old, they can no longer live in a village. So this is something for the Sami here, that these pictures. And then we had our conference in Rwanda in 2015. Now in August, we had our conference in India, in Indore. This is our next conference that comes up now in September. Please come to Egypt, to Cairo. Whoever wants to come, send me an email. I send you an invitation letter. And then in next year, in September, we have our conference in the Amazon in Brazil. If you want to come, please contact me. And the people in the Amazon, they invite us already now to contribute with videos. This is their invitation. I jump over it because of the time. So we, as I said, we have 1,000 members in the core of our network, and we invite them. If they have a guest house, a guest room in the house, we invite them to declare their home to be a dignity dialogue home. So we have about many, many homes around the world for our dignity network. And these are my homes. I go from home to home to home to home. And we have, as Vida said, we have launched the World Dignity University Initiative, and it has a publishing house. And now I switch hat again, and I now will tell you which books I have written. As Vida said, the first book, Making Enemies, then the second book, third and fourth book, A Dignity Economy. And if you are interested in these books, Tomoka has, I sent you a long email. You have the link to all the books there. No, you didn't know that.
So, Evelyn and I have them.
And you have them. So all the books you have access to digitally if you want to. Okay? So this was now in December, our conference in New York. So welcome next December to New York. And this conference in New York now had the title The Nature of Dignity. I make a mistake. The Nature of Dignity and the Dignity of Nature. And we had a longer text on that, and I think I will jump over that now. And this is my last book. It came out now in 2017. This is also the title of this talk. And this is a summary of this book. The summary of it, or the message of it, is the following. Humankind has reached a boiling point, hijacked by toxic competition for domination, for dominance. Might has become right. The consequence is ubiquitous destruction executed through tools of terror. This book is a globally informed account of how we can reverse this rising tide, making dignity our destiny and legacy before it is too late. Is there hope? Do you see what is written there?
There's only hope if you stand up, not otherwise. And you remember that on Monday we had a talk from a Sami professor, whether the Sami should have a, or they will have a truth commission here. So what we learn is, if when you want to stand up, and I expect you to stand up, then we have to be careful to keep unity in diversity, to stay clear of turning diversity into division. This was his talk, basically. His talk was about how to not turn diversity into division, how to stay together. So thank you very much. This is Norwegian for thank you very much. It is origato, origato, osainas. It is thank you very much. Many other languages. Who other language? What is say thank you very much in your language, my mother tongue? Agbe. Agbe. No, I can't. So I say thank you very much to you all, and now I think we have a little bit of time until 11, where we can go into dialogue. I, as you see, you understand now why I like dialogue rather than questions and answers. I don't like questions and answers, because I'm not the expert. You have to become the expert. And so we have time for dialogue. And then after 11, whoever has time can learn a little bit about the Pied Piper's legend, which you know also explains the history in Europe and so on. I have pictures here for you after 11, if you wish, if you have. And then I would love to have a group picture with Gandhi. To put it on our website, if you will give the permission. So this is my plan, my hope for you now, from now on. Are you okay with that? Mm-hmm. And I think we can switch off the camera now, so we are...